Hello, it's Thursday, 11th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson. On today's show, I'll be discussing sustainability in aviation with my guest, Philip C., Group Chief Sustainability Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Loyalty and Travel Services for the Malaysian Aviation Group. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. As sustainability targets in aviation become ever more important, airlines and governments in the region are racing to implement strategies from sustainable aviation fuel levies to in-house training. And with recent news just this week that Malaysia will start to implement its own carbon levy, what better timing than to speak to Philip C., Group Chief Sustainability Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Loyalty and Travel Services for the Malaysian Aviation Group. So, Philip, welcome to the Southeast Asia Travel Show. How are you doing and where are you right now?
Hi, Hannah. I'm doing great. It's the second day of Raya Eid in Malaysia. So I'm nice at home, just relaxing, chilling, reading, taking long walks all around the neighborhood. So yeah, doing very good.
Nice. That sounds like a good way to be spending the public holiday and not balik kampung. So you're missing the traffic, just chilling out in KL like I am.
I've got to say, KL was pretty crowded. I mean, in past Rayas, you know, it would be crickets and there'll be nobody in the city. But yeah, I see some mobility and movement around the city still. So it's not entirely empty.
Yeah, I mean, I was just at the Exchange, which is like this super new mall in KL. Yeah. And it was packed, absolutely packed at lunchtime Raptors. Just now. Oh, my goodness. So let's get down to it. We've got loads to talk about. But first of all, I want to talk about you, Philip, because I think you've had a really interesting career journey. So you've gone from kind of analyst to, you know, your current role looking after sustainability, loyalty, travel solutions for the Malaysian Aviation Group. That's quite a leap. So tell us how you wound up in travel.
Well, as you know, Hannah, I did a degree in chemical engineering, so it was not natural for me to be in the aviation industry. But I love the industry. It's been a hobby. I actually collect airline timetables when they used to be in vogue about 20 years ago. So my university in London was in South Kensington. So I picked a place in Turnham Green to stay so that I could go over the weekends to Heathrow Airport to collect airline timetables. And during my free time, I would draw fictitious airline route maps, right? So it was always a passion. But I was, I guess, part of the Asian parents under a lot of pressure to do something practical. So I did chemical engineering, and then I was in banking, then I was in consulting in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. And there was this opening at that time under the then CEO of Malaysia Airlines, Idris Jalla. And I just thought, why don't I just take the leap and try and see whether I could fit in there? And I joined, I applied. I took quite a bit of a pay cut and actually a downgrade in the job, but it was the best experience I had. I had a great team. I loved my boss. I loved the teams. And I just grew from there. So that was my first stint that time at Malaysia Airlines. I then left and joined that time the boss Idris, who became then a minister in the Prime Minister's office, and I followed him. And then I just moved around consulting, did my own business. And as you recall, for Malaysia Airlines, they went through MH370 and MH17. And there was a massive restructuring that took place. And they brought an incoming CEO, Christoph Müller. And then I got rehired to rejoin back the airline there. And at that time, my focus was very much on partnerships. And essentially, you know, starting with that role, I kind of grew from strength to strength, I guess, doing network, fleet planning, strategy, and then moved on to the role of Firefly and then back to the group again in the past 2 years.
I love that. It's really been a dance then, right, between airlines and not, and airlines and not. And I love the thought of you going and collecting all of these timetables. Have you still got them?
No more, because my mom chucked it all away. So, but I have actually, if you can see, I mean, I probably can't see, but in my room, I actually have boarding pass tickets. And actually in my free time, like I would draw fictitious airline schedules, right? And would have an A4 and draw route maps. And that was something that I still do in my hobby and free time.
Do you? Wow, that's super. Yes, yeah. You're an airline guy through and through.
Yes, yes.
So you were CEO of Firefly Airlines for 4 years, and that was just prior and then going into the pandemic. So obviously, it must have been a really difficult time for that. So what changes were you starting to see in Firefly's model? Because it's quite a unique model, I suppose, before the pandemic. And then how did you react going into the pandemic itself?
Yeah, so 4 years in Firefly, and I would say really I could break it into three phases. The first year was just trying to focus on the turboprop operations, and that was very challenging because it was actually quite competitive, turboprop operations in Subang, and it was a very price sensitive market. And then the 2 years pandemic was a totally different ballgame. And I think just looking at your facial expression, you know, I think it still brings shudders to many of us at the time. And then the final fourth year was really an expansion mode where Firefly then re-entered back into the jet era, actually. So really, I think it was really a very interesting time for me, having to repivot the business, I think, 2-3 times in that span of 4 years for me. But the first year, naturally, my biggest challenge was actually we were not allowed to fly back to Changi. And so restarting Seletar was actually my first crisis, actually, when joining Firefly then, and still trying to navigate the business. And it was a very challenging market. And of course, the pandemic changed everything.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's interesting about Singapore, because I presume that must be one of the more premium routes for Firefly, right? Because that's really a selling point, that you just get into Seletar and there's like pretty much you're the only flight arriving in. It's super quick and you go in, and the same from Subang. It's like really that commuter flight, right, between the two countries.
Absolutely. I think people pay premium because of the airports, actually, to be honest, not the flight itself. Because literally for both sides, you can get from curbside to the gate in under 10 minutes. And that's not something you can get at KLI or at Changi. So really the door-to-door experience on that was really important. So making the decision to move from Changi to Seletar was really important. There was also a bit of risk because there were weight restrictions. There were time restrictions as well. And just deciding to make the call whether to do it was a challenging decision to make.
Yeah, I bet. But yeah, one that pays off. If I'm flying to Singapore, I'm always checking how much more expensive is that? Just the thought of driving all the way out to KLIA, which is about an hour, versus Subang, which from my place is what, 20 minutes. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is a premium you can offer, right, and charge, actually, because people are willing to pay that premium. And that's what made the route profitable.
Yeah, I imagine. Talking more about the pandemic, and during the pandemic, Malaysia Airlines Group was recapitalized, restructured, and Firefly kind of assumed a different strategic position within the group. And you've kind of hinted at that, but can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, so for us, you know, it's interesting because Firefly was turboprop operations throughout most of the pandemic. And we actually were still flying still, you know, throughout the region because of the small capacity, and there were restricted movements. But with the turboprop, we still were able to provide strategic connectivity, especially around Peninsula Malaysia. So actually, the mode was a bit different compared to the bigger jet sister, right, Malaysia Airlines, where there was really literally a near close halt to operations, although, of course, they were very good in pivoting to the cargo business. But with Firefly, I think there were still some flights, so momentum was still there. But, you know, we had to restructure as a whole group our balance sheet and thinking out loud the different scenarios, right, in case the restructuring failed and what would happen. And so being able to prepare Firefly to even operate as a jet was actually essential in the event that the restructuring would fail on the group side. But as we all know, you know, the past is the past, and it was successful, and now the airline is soaring and doing extremely well. By that time, you know, it was a very different calculation and preparing for contingencies. So Firefly actually, before, some time ago, was actually a jet operator, if you recall. And then there was that whole restructuring merger between Malaysia Airlines and AirAsia. And as a result of that merger, actually, Firefly exited the jet business. And at the time, it was actually quite cannibalizing because they were run by separate commercial teams. But what you notice now, actually, with the new restructured group, you have one single airline CEO that manages all the brands. So there is a lot of commercial synergy now. So those were the kind of shifts we took place. And so throughout the pandemic, especially the later end of the pandemic, We then launched jet operations, right, just to make sure that we were able to be ready, right, for any eventuality. And in the end, the business pivoted to something a bit more fundamental, which was actually having jet operations from secondary cities all across Malaysia, like Penang and Kota Kinabalu.
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting, especially the focus on developing Penang as a hub. You can see more airlines are talking about that and looking at that. And you've even got players what like the longer haul ones, Qatar Airways or Fly Dubai coming in to Penang
That's
as
right.
well. So it's that's really interesting. So kind of speeding up to the present day and looking at your roles now, and I wanted to dig into a little bit around your travel services, which I presume is a lot around ancillary revenues. So talk us through, Malaysian Aviation Group's plans for ancillary revenue. You've got travel solutions now like Journify, you have MH Holidays. So how key are these to boosting the group's long-term revenue streams?
I think just some context. Again, the pandemic taught us very critical lessons that we cannot entirely rely on passenger airline business. So the group decided to make sure that we set the frame to diversify our business beyond just airline tickets. So what I think was a concerted effort was A, you wanted to streamline the airline commercial and operational functions between all the different airline brands of Malaysia Airlines, Firefly, Amal, and Marswings. On the flip side, you also wanted to make sure that revenue of the non-air also was growing. And that's why in the new structure for Malaysia Aviation Group, you have a CEO of Loyalty Travel Services, which is a bit more consumer-centric. And then you have the CEO of Aviation Services, which is a bit more B2B-centric. So the two of us have an important role to make sure that we build a revenue base that's not overly dependent on just passenger airline, taking a cue from the pandemic. So for us, of course, on the Loyalty Travel Services side, there are a couple of objectives. One, of course, is the ancillary non-air revenue, which is very important because actually, when a customer books an airline ticket, you actually have them in the flow, and you have such an interesting opportunity to offer so many services, be it insurance, be it hotel bookings, be it attractions, be it car rental, be it transfers, right? Because the customer, you clearly have them on the flow at the passenger booking site. But there are also some customers that actually don't book the flight first, but they book the experience in the hotel first. And so we also offer that, but it's through a non-airline brand like Genify. But what's very important for that is to cross-sell the airline ticket later. So for example, recently Malaysia Airlines is launching Maldives. And for someone that goes to Maldives, usually the hotel is more important. Getting the resort sorted out is more important. And then later you think about the flight, right? And so that's the role and synergistic role we play on both sides, right? In terms of A, getting passengers who don't naturally consider Malaysia Airlines first as your first point of call, either because of the brand or because of the fact that people for that itinerary would never pick a flight. Or if someone picks an airline flight, how do you get and cross-sell other items later?
Yeah, I mean, and this is a space that I used to be in. So I used to work for a company called GoQuo, who did all of this dynamic packaging, and I was involved. Even when I was back with Sedunia Holidays and this was Sedunia Travel, and this is really way back. I remember they looked after Firefly Holidays back then, which was like very offline kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I really it amazes me that not more airlines are in this kind of dynamic packaging game because, like you say, you've got the data on the customer. You know exactly where they're going, when they're going, what kind of fare class they've booked, if they're loyalty, you've got all that past history. You've got an enormous amount of data to really tailor, right, those offerings to them.
A lot of work still needed to do to personalize, right?
Always.
Like, if someone is booking a flight, but maybe they found the flight expensive or not good, then how do you counter offer other things, right? Like a bundle package. I think in Europe, bundling packaging is really seeing some renaissance back again. Maybe in Asia, it's not yet fully on board because people still can't see the bundling, but we anticipate that to be substantial business in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So moving a little bit to loyalty then, which is your other hat, one of many hats. Obviously airline loyalty programs, they've seen huge shifts over the last couple of years, decade even. What's Enrich's future? What's that look like?
Well, it's interesting. Again, right, for us, it was naturally a pivot away from airline in the beginning of the pandemic because there wasn't much flying. And so Enrich was quite key to keep on engaging customers, right? But to engage, you offered a lot of lifestyle related parts. But in essence, the essence of Enrich is that it's still an airline loyalty program. So its future and its strategy is very much intertwined with the airline. You can't kind of run away from it. And so its growth strategy is linked to that. But I think what's important is that it's the markets it served, right? And in Malaysia, yes, you have a core corporate business flow, but you also have quite a large leisure VFR centric flow. And the offer here is how do you offer customers an opportunity to redeem and earn, even for less frequent travel, right? And so that I think is one of the biggest things that Enrich is working on. A, look, you still have to reward those high frequency travelers. And at the same time, how do you offer non-air perks and also rewards, right, that are non-air as well? So that's a bit more unique, I guess, for the markets we operate with in Enrich. For us, really, Enrich has to have a very digital centric approach because it's all about personalization. It's about saying, oh, you are the kind of customer. And so, what kind of rewards and perks do you get for that flight, for that experience? And so, I don't think you can run away from it being intrinsically linked to the airline. But you have to start offering non-air opportunities to earn and also redeem and reward yourself because of the nature of our markets.
Yeah, I see now why you're saying you're the more customer facing and how the loyalty, it works basically having you oversee these travel services and the loyalty at the same time because it can all be part of the same kind of bundle and offering.
And you see that happening in AIG, IAG, right? With IAG Loyalty now even taking the holiday business. So I think the foresight of my boss to kind of look at that, I think, was testament to him.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really excited now to dig into the other large part of your role, which is around sustainability. You know, sustainability in aviation is a huge, huge topic. So take us through some of those kind of top line goals that MAG has set as a company.
I think, we are still very young in the journey for sure. And I think there are many in Asia and around the world that really trailblazed it, to be very frank. So for us, it's really just looking at what's happening all around the world and emulating it and making sure it works well to us back in Malaysia. So, being part of the One World Alliance, being part of IATA, there are these very clear commitments, for net zero by 2050, and even having some commitments on sustainable aviation fuel by 2030 as part of the broader alliance, and even with AAPA with the 5% target, and recently coming out from ICAO. So these are really external visions and goals, I think, that are mirrored internally in the organization. For us, really, sustainability is intrinsically about how can you minimize your footprint, wherever you go. Because we believe travel is such an important way to connect communities and people. But the important part is how do you, reduce your footprint? And so really emissions is a very important part of that goal, right? But when you think about airline and aviation sustainability, it's very broad, right, beyond that, because you have goals like governance, social, and even other parts of the environment which are not emission related. For example, waste, water, even human trafficking, wildlife trafficking, even things like diversity in the workplace, community, connecting community. So sustainability is a very huge gamut, to be honest. But yes, to be honest, emissions is always front and center, the biggest emphasis, but the team here has to take a more holistic view.
It is, it is always just beyond that environmental angle. And I'll definitely ask you about that in a bit. But I do want to dig a little bit more into the environmental one and around SAF in particular. And it's interesting because Gary and I, we always have this discussion, and I'm very much a SAF advocate. And Gary, if he probably won't mind me saying, is always a little bit more cynical around it. I know that MAG has flown some SAF-powered awareness flights. Where are you in terms of adopting that technology? Is SAF going to be the solution?
I think it it cannot be the sole solution, but it's going to be one of the key pillars, right? And there's a lot of debate. I think, Hannah and you, Gary, you dispute about this. I suspect the dispute is a bit more nuanced, which is at what point does it scale? At what point does it become meaningful? I think it's really the big debate. Of course, in Europe and in America, if you look at the technology roadmap, you don't really see any clear pathway, right, besides SAF. But there are even many branches within SAF to agree which are the right pathways, right? Is it HEFA? Is it alcohol to jet? Is it PTL? Do we go to hydrogen? So I think those are still not clear yet. And it's very different for each airline and each markets you operate in, to be honest. So for us in the group, as you were mentioning, we have run experimental flights. The key and next challenge now is to put something structural in place. And for that, really, we are running a couple of parallel initiatives to really test and see where we land, right, in terms of what is the structural idea for SAF. So the group's perspective is that we do need to take SAF very seriously. We don't think it's something that is a 12-month or 24-month horizon, but something that's clearly something that we have to really show tangibly and deliver substantially, at least at the tail end of the 2020s, right? Or for sure at a substantive level in the early 2030s. So that's very clear on our side.
And I guess one of the challenges that you're facing is then how do you procure SAF and how, in Malaysia and how will it be produced? Have you got any ideas around that?
Interestingly, in Malaysia, we get solicited by many interested parties who have thoughts and about building SAF facilities. Naturally, it's always gravitated around used cooking oil. We really challenge them to say, can you make sure your feedstock is certified? Can you certify your SAF according to CORSIA and ICAO requirements? I think that is always the problem. So there have been parallel studies on feedstock in Malaysia. And we are quite clear that I think if we rely on HEFA and used cooking oil, I don't think that's going to pass muster. I don't think that's going to be enough. And so some amount of innovation and effort is required to look beyond that. And if we, I think, broaden our horizons, and it doesn't need to be palm oil, it can be other forms of feedstock, I think we can solve a large chunk of the goal, but not in entirety, in my view.
Yeah, so it's a tricky one, isn't it? And it's not one thing that just the private sector can solve. Is this everybody figuring out? And like you say, it's structural, getting that structure into place.
And I would say it's very important that we also want diversification of solutions because that's going to drive innovation. That's also going to drive, a bit more stability in future prices. Because if you look at where we are now in terms of fuel, it's volatile, it's moving up and down. So having a diversification of the feedstock, it's actually good structurally for the business. It removes the uncertainty and volatility of a very key commodity, right, for us in the flying business.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I wanted to move into a kind of what role the government has to play in pushing SAF. And of course, Singapore announced that all departing flights from 2026 must use SAF. They're planning to impose, a levy or so on passengers. And of course, just this week, MAVCOM here in Malaysia is saying that, I mean, they have not really specified, it's still a bit vague, but essentially that they are changing some legislation to allow carbon levies, but are not saying exactly what that would be. They're saying it's not going to be compulsory. So, do you think Singapore is making the right move? Are we going to see something similar in Malaysia? Is there going to be this domino effect and all the governments across ASEAN are going to start implementing something like this?
It is interesting, I think, for Singapore to implement. And I think it is a bit trailblazing because it's kind of implying, look, it's the customer that has to pay for it when you initiate something like that, right? And that it's not the industry, it's not the government, it is going down to the consumer to pay. And naturally, because Singapore being a hub, how do you manage that in a holistic manner without it causing carbon leakage? When someone now, instead of flying via Singapore, goes to KL or Jakarta or Bangkok as a hub, right? You still will burn. So I'm of the view that when we make these bold moves, I think multilateral institutions like ICAO or CORSIA really have to pull everybody together and create some common framework to do this work. It is a very bold move, but my hope is that we find some regional global coordination about these efforts, right? So that we don't end up trying different things and then later have to force to backtrack or U-turn or converge to something later. Better to take a very clear global stance and standard about these things, in my view. But that's very impossible. That's very hard to do. But I rather take small baby steps at a global level than unilateral markets pursuing it. But I can appreciate why Singapore also thought that it was very important to take the leadership stance. But it is challenging, and I guess the jury's out to see how it will impact in the midterm, long term. And the announcement, I think, still has to put in place the details of the implementation of how you run that, right? So let's see.
Yes. It's always, on the podcast, we've seen so many times governments put out these edicts and then have not really thought about how they would actually implement it. Like Thailand's tourism fee is a great one, and I've talked about it loads of times, how they're almost just about implement it, and then they realize, oh, actually, we don't quite know how to implement that. We'll roll it back. We'll roll it back. We'll roll it back. So yeah, it's an interesting one. So as you said earlier, sustainability isn't just environmental. Social impacts too. So what is the group doing to support the social elements of sustainability?
I mean, I think it's reminding us, Malaysia Aviation Group is national carrier, and what we do is we connect communities, right? And there are so many things we need to do to bring people together. And that's something that we intend to do and make sure we continue to unify the country. On the flip side, it's also about celebrating diversity. And that's what Malaysia is so famous for, right? And so it's very important for us to think about diversity from a broader angle, beyond just gender, age, intellectual diversity. A whole range of different gamuts of how we think about diversification, right, is something that we work very hard. But of course, the main focus for us is, of course, women, especially in technical professions like in engineering and in flight operations, i.e., pilots, and getting more women on board for those kind of roles are really important targets because they're quite low at the moment in the group. So how do we push that? It's actually a quite high priority for the business.
How can you go about encouraging more women to become pilots? Are there any kind of specific initiatives that you guys have launched or are looking at?
There is, I think, for us, but it comes back again to, if you want it sustainable, it is creating the environment and the flexible arrangements, but more fundamentally, role models, just putting it out there that actually you can have a great career as a woman engineer, as a woman pilot, right? So that is the most important traction to do. Trying to put quotas is important in the end state, but we need to first build the funnel and make sure that there's a lot of people interested to come in. Because if you don't build the funnel at the top, and you try to restrict at the bottom, it's also challenging, right? And we are at an infancy stage. Maybe later there could be, but let's build the funnel first.
Absolutely. And so my final question to you, I mean, and you were talking about how there are plenty of other airlines who you would consider to be those trailblazers. So who outside of Southeast Asia do you see at the moment is leading the pack when it comes to sustainability for aviation?
I mean, everybody brings something to the table. To be honest, like in the collaborations, even airlines like AirAsia do a lot on fuel efficiency, and that's so important, right? And to emulate and see what they do is something to look forward to. Look at how Cathay Pacific thinks a bit on SAF and how they try to expand that whole flow. It's also very commendable. So I wouldn't pinpoint to say one has got it right for everything, but clearly, each airline has taken very clear thoughts about how they want to go ahead with it, right? Maybe we may not share the same level of momentum or prioritization, but definitely I am inspired by airlines, not only in Asia, but around the world, to think about how they do it and do it well.
Yeah, that was a diplomatic answer, but yeah, I think it feeds back to your idea. I mean, how everything it should really be collaborative, and should everybody should be kind of setting these
Yes,
targets in tandem, right,
absolutely.
and together.
All right.
Yeah. Well, with that, that brings the show to a close for the week. So thank you so much, Philip, for coming on. It's been super interesting to talk sustainability and loyalty and all sorts of stuff with you.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Hannah. And I hope you have an enjoyable evening and don't overeat.
Thank you. So we hope you enjoyed the podcast, listeners. And don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on anything I discussed with Philip or anything I missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show. And as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and find us on any international podcast platform. So that's a wrap for today. Gary will be back next week, and we look forward to talking more Southeast Asia travel and tourism with you very soon.